Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, I write the songs that make the whole world sing. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And today we wanted to talk about musical composition. We talked about musical performance in a previous podcast, but now we're going to talk about actually writing music and composing it. And, you know, of course, some of our most famous music creators are now decomposers. That's a pun. Lauren's just silently shaking her head. So the discussion I thought would be fun, you know, you Joe, came up with a great little point of research about the earliest known written musical notation.
Right, because of course we've been creating music, you know, even singing or, you know, percussion on drums or rib cages or et cetera, for many, 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 many years.
Oh, yeah.
But,
Yeah, we talked about in our last podcast that we don't even know how old music is.
And right.
We imagine we've been making it for, you know, tens of thousands of years. We know it's at least about 40,000 years old because that's how old the oldest bone flutes are.
But when it comes to written music, I mean, obviously anything that's a written account, it's going to take a lot for it to be able to survive, you know, centuries and centuries.
Yeah, when you think about it, this is kind of strange and creepy. We don't know what that music sounded like.
Yeah, we have no way of knowing.
You could just try to guess, but there's no way to know.
Yeah, those vinyl albums are no longer on store shelves. Yeah, no, there's no way of recording it from, you know, they didn't have any way of recording it back then apart from writing things down. And the earliest version we have of that came from a city called Ugarit. It's in Syria. It was actually written on clay tablets.
At least the Babylonians.
No, it was the Hurrians.
Oh, okay.
In fact, the Hurrians were an ancient people who spoke Hurro-Uritian. It was a language, and they were from what is now, well, what would eventually be northern Mesopotamia. That's a little B-52s for you. But no, they were from that area of Mesopotamia, but now it's known as Syria. Or at least that's where the clay tablets were found, these specific tablets. And the tablets had two sections to them. The top section were lyrics. They were words. This was a song, not just a piece of music, but a song. And the lower section was musical annotation. It was actually as if it were sheet music for us today. Of course, the problem is that we don't have any ancient Hurrians sitting around to tell us exactly what this musical annotation meant. So it took some interpretation upon the part of scholars, particularly Dr. Richard Drumbrill. He spent a great deal of time trying to figure out exactly what this annotation meant. And the surviving tune is called Hurrian Hymn Number 6, and it comes from about 1400 BCE.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's essentially a hymn to the moon god's wife, Nicol.
We should put up a link to this because I've heard some of these reproductions.
Yeah.
And obviously, these are just interpretations.
Right, because again, we don't know for sure if the interpretation we have.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like it has a series of sort of number symbols, I think.
Yeah.
That we're just guessing, like, well, we think that means this series of notes within a mode or something.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's our best guess, essentially. I mean, it's an educated guess, but it's still a guess.
Yeah. But anyway, these interpretations of the notation are pretty haunting. They sound pretty cool to me.
Yeah. We'll do a blog post that goes along with this one, just as we did with the last one, where we'll have some links to some sound samples. We'll also include the videos. There's a great video of a musician named Michael Levi, who was playing on a solo lyre, and that his version is very haunting and beautiful. And then there was another one that we listened to by the musician Malek Jandali, who is a pianist, but he performed also with the Ludwig Symphony Orchestra. And so you have a full orchestral version and a solo lyre version, and it's interesting to listen to these two very different interpretations of the same set of music.
Yeah, and then there are even much more different interpretations than that
sure.
that I saw, and it seems a lot of people have been taking a stab at what this sounded like.
That's right. Terrific.
yeah, it's really cool. I want to get in on this game, but I just don't know enough about music.
Yeah, and same here. I'm pretty sure that if I were to attempt the Hurrian Hymn number 6 on my ukulele, it would not sound anything like the Hurrians would have imagined.
Okay, but so that kind of thing, we can't, we don't know exactly what it's supposed to sound like, but eventually we did get some modes of musical notation that are comprehensible to us today.
Right.
And, that were more standardized within their culture.
Sure.
And that now we pretty much know how we're supposed to interpret.
Right, right. Even if you are looking at an antiquated piece of music, we have enough information about what those different scales of music and different keys, all that kind of information. We already know that. So even if it was written in a way that's antiquated, we can translate that into a more modern version so that your typical musician would be able to
read
play
it
that.
And
yeah,
play it.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, you know, like, just like we said in the musical performance, episode, a lot of this ends up being down to musical expression as well. So even if something is written one way on the page, just as you would expect today, you get two different musicians to play the same piece of music, you're going to get two different experiences from that.
Yeah, and so in the sort of the Western classical tradition, we have a very like notation-based way of thinking about mm-hmm. music. So you have a musical staff, you know, and you've written out the notes on it in the standard notation, and you know
the tempo.
And you can read from that, and that's how you deal with music. But I think there are tons of musicians these days who really never even deal with standard Western classical music notation.
No, they learn their instrument. They learn what their instrument is capable, the sounds that the instrument makes. They know, you know, they may either have a true understanding or maybe an intuitive understanding of the way that chord progressions need to go, that sort of thing, the things that sound pleasing to mm-hmm. that particular culture's ear.
Well, also we don't need to write those things down in order to reproduce them later, because we can make audio records of that music.
Exactly. Yeah, I feel like to some extent the audio recording has eroded the place that was once held by written music notation, mm-hmm. because when you can record a song, it's not so imperative that you write it down. People can, well, we can always go listen to it and then just reverse engineer how it was played.
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah. And in fact, there are computer programs that can do that are pretty interesting.
Exactly. So I think a lot of people who compose music these days use electronically aided composition.
Sure. Yeah, and I've actually got quite a few examples of that. One of the earliest ones that ultimately was not successful in the market, but I thought was interesting to talk about, came from a guy named Sid Meier. Now, Joe, have you ever heard the name Sid Meier?
Everyone in civilization has heard of Sid Meier.
That is a little bit of a pun, because Sid Meier was the original creator and designer for the Civilization series of video games that you guys might be familiar with.
He also created an awesome game called Pirates. Anyway, yeah, so Sid Meier, known as a video game designer, he had formed a company called MicroProse along with Bill Steely, or Wild Bill Steely as he's known. And the two of them started making and selling video games. And after he experienced some early success, Sid Meier decided he wanted to try something new. He didn't want to keep making military simulations, which was chiefly what MicroProse was known for in those early days. He wanted to branch out, do something different.
Mm-hmm. And he was a big fan of music. I believe sings in his church choir.
He plays the organ. Mm-hmm. Yep. So he thought, why don't I create some software that allows people to create their own compositions in different styles? And that's when he went out and made a program called CPU Bach. And I actually watched a demonstration of this software, and it was played on the 3DO. Do you guys know what the 3DO is?
Yes.
It sounds funny.
Okay, so the 3DO was a game console system. It was meant to be like a full entertainment system. It's a predecessor to the systems that we see today. Things like the Xbox and PlayStation models are really kind of the next step of what the 3DO was supposed to be. But the problem was the 3DO came out a little too early and way too expensive for
right.
the market.
This was what? Was it the late 80s, early
90s? It was 90s, okay. Yeah.
Did the 3DO have some of those interactive movies on it?
Oh, yeah. No, this was the same time that we started seeing full motion video get incorporated into video games. And the problem was that everyone was putting full motion video into video games without thinking about how to actually make it part of the game. So it became a real gimmick. And you ended up getting these terribly acted shots of full motion video that just were not, you know, it looked like
it was pointless.
Yeah, it looked like the kind of stuff you would get on your television if you had really bad reception. It just was not a very satisfying experience.
Was there full motion video in CPU Bach?
No, it was actually all graphics from what I could tell, or at least the stuff I saw was all graphics. So it wasn't.
I was kidding, but
it could have been. It could have been
okay.
Because it was for the 3DO, and so the way it worked was that you would be able to create music in various classical modes. So you could do a concerto, or you could even do a symphony if you wanted to, and a chamber orchestra piece, and you would sit down and you would start to compose this stuff through this interface, and then at the end of it, it would have a full piece of music. But it did not sell very well. Very few people really picked it up. I don't think the market was quite ready for it at the time that it came out. So ultimately, this was not a success. But there are plenty of programs out there that have various features that are great for musicians. Like, here's an example of one. There's one called the Finale Songwriter. Finale Songwriter allows you to create musical notations, you know, so you can get that sheet music you want if you want to have it written down. You could play a song on a MIDI device, so any device that is MIDI compatible. MIDI is a set of standards for music, for computer music. If you were to have, say, a keyboard that's a MIDI keyboard and you have it plugged into your computer and you play the song exactly the way you want it, this program can then translate that into musical notation. So you can actually print that out and hand that to someone else and say, here's the song I wrote, and now you can play it too. You could also, if you wanted to, program the song note by note. As instead of playing something dynamically and have it be recorded and transformed, you could very systematically go through and say, I want this particular note at this pitch, at this tempo, and
for this length and go.
Yeah, you could build it like you could build a computer algorithm. If you wanted to do that, you could. You could essentially be Data,
you know,
from Star Trek.
That's interesting to me. I mean, because with that kind of capability, you sort of expand what the average person can do, especially, like, say, if you're not the greatest performer. Like, what if you want to write music, but you don't have really good rhythm yourself or something?
Or if you're incapable of hitting a note on a particular instrument.
Or you just have some form of impairment that would, you know, maybe you don't have the full use of both of your hands, but you have a very musically tuned mind. You can think of the music you want to play, and if you had that capability, you could play it, but perhaps you've lost it, or perhaps you never had it in the first place. This gives you that freedom of creating that piece of music. It's kind of like thinking about how Beethoven was able to create incredible symphonies even as his hearing was going away. It's that, you know, you never know. There may be the next Beethoven who is incapable of playing a musical instrument. But the other reason I bring up Beethoven is to talk about the third piece of software. And keep in mind, like I said, there are lots of different examples. I just picked three, kind of. This piece of software is called Ludwig. And Ludwig is music software specifically for the Windows platform. And again, there are different ones for Macs as well. But it lets you create music. So what you do is you insert a melody into this software. So you have to create the melody. But once you insert the melody, it starts to fill out the rest of the song with chords and other elements to make it a full song and not just a melody. And it does this by following specific rules for specific genres. So you pick the genre you want, and then it will fill that out and put it to the right tempo for that genre with the right sound in the background. It's interesting. I would say that it comes out sounding very much like MIDI music. So in other words, it's not sounding like a big, rich, you know, diverse set of musical instruments.
Sure, but something a little bit fancier than what you would get on, say, a electric organ, the way that my grandparents had in their house, that you could just put, like, ragtime beat number two in the background of.
Yeah, so it's interesting because what they'd ended up doing was they pulled in some sheet music again. In this case, they pulled out a piece of music that was in public domain from the video I watched, and then applied different musical genres to it, so they could play like two different styles of music with the same set of notes, the same melody. And that was kind of interesting to hear how it came out. So we're starting to see computer assisted composition here.
not just assisted in that it's giving you some tools to work with, but assisted in that it's actually sort of
helping
suggesting
generate
ideas for content.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. So,
I mean, and this kind of thing goes back to, I know that one of Ray Kurzweil's first projects was, I mean, when he was like a teenager, this is probably about in 1965, I believe,
yeah.
was a piece of software that would analyze classical compositions and
compose its own yeah.
based on those rules, those algorithms that
Kurzweil, of course,
learn.
Well known for his work in artificial intelligence, voice recognition, also a well-known futurist, aspiring cyborg. He's waiting for that singularity to hit us any day now.
20 to 40 years.
20 to 40 years. But yeah, so that's one of the things he was known for, was this early computer program that could compose its own music.
Well, that leads me to a really interesting idea, and it's something I touched on in the script I wrote about this episode.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of algorithmic composition. Okay, so we already know this is possible, that we can get computers to write viable music themselves. And actually, we already talked about it in another podcast, the idea of, say, AI storytelling, but that's actually a lot more difficult, right?
Because the rules of human language are such that they're really, really complicated and kind of squidgy.
Yeah.
So
you'd need millions of rules in order to create a coherent story out of nothing, unless you were just using like some pre-built skeleton or whatever, Mad Libs. But to create a piece of music, that's actually a lot easier because music already is very susceptible to data.
It's pretty mathematical when you break it down to its bare bones.
Sure, yeah.
And it's easier to tell a computer what the rules of music are than, say, what the rules of storytelling and language are. And so I can very much see, even more so than the AI storyteller we discussed, the possibility of an AI musical composer. Okay, so imagine you've got a music service like Pandora.
Okay.
Okay. And Pandora, what does it do to give you the songs that you want to hear?
It follows the Music Genome Project. So in other words, you tell Pandora what kind of song or what kind of band you are interested in. It starts to look for other bands or other songs that share those same sort of qualities, and then it serves those up to you.
Yeah, what does it do? So you tell it, say, you know, I really like a song by Meatloaf.
All right, so Paradise by the Dashboard Light.
Yeah, that's the song I give it. So how does it know what I like? Well, does it just give me other songs by Meatloaf?
No.
No. Well, let's say, does it just give me other songs that are filed under the same genre category as Meatloaf?
No.
No? Well, what? Does it just give me songs that are on the same label that that album was on?
No. Joe, would you like me to tell you what it gives you?
Yeah. How does it figure out what songs go with Paradise by the Dashboard Light?
It's really cool because what they do is they have people listening to songs and they start to classify all the different elements that go into making that song. So it's kind of the metadata for an individual song. So
you mean the musical features?
The musical features. Everything from, is it a single vocalist? Is it a duet? In the case of Paradise by the Dashboard Light, yes it is. Is it a ballad? Is it rock and roll? Does it have a lot of electric guitar in it? Does
it
have a lot of synthesizer? There are all these different elements that go into it. And so a single song may have 40 or 50 or more different specific features that have been singled out in Pandora.
Yeah. Right.
And so then it starts to look for other songs that contain a certain number of those tags, and then it serves that song up to you. Then you have the option of either hitting thumbs up, I love this song, and make sure you play this kind of stuff more frequently, or thumbs down, this is not what I'm looking for. And as you give input back into the program, it starts to refine that algorithm. Maybe it starts to think that, okay, this guy really likes cheesy songs, but every single solo artist I've ever given him, he has thumbs down. So we are not going to do any more solo from now on. It's all going to be duets or bands or whatever. And then it'll start to refine your channel over time.
Okay, so imagine a program like this. It starts to get a really specific musical taste profile on you. It tells, you know, it figures out, and let's imagine that it's even more advanced than Pandora is today. Like, it gets a really specific profile. You like these 50 features in songs. Right now, what it has to do is try to go through its whole library and match songs that have as many of the features you like and as few of the features you dislike as possible.
Sure.
But using algorithmic composition, we could imagine that it could technically create songs that have exactly what you want.
So
which is kind of creepy.
So if you really love Paradise by the Dashboard Light and you love all the things that go into making that song what it is.
But you can't just listen to the one song over and over forever.
You get bored eventually.
You can listen to it three times and that takes up half a day. The song is long. It's like a 12-minute long song. But it could, in theory, let's say it's following those rules, it could start to produce other songs that match the same sort of criteria dynamically. So this is, you're literally hearing this song for the first time. In fact, you're the first person to hear this song for the first time, and maybe no one ever hears that song again because it's making it specifically to match what you want to hear at that moment.
Now, we already have algorithmic composition, and we already have things like Pandora that can create a really intense taste profile for the listener. So why don't we already have this? Well, I'd say one thing that's standing in the way is that algorithmic composition, while it's really good, probably isn't quite there yet in terms of its precision. And also, I'd say the biggest impediment right now is just the fact that the computer-generated sounds aren't as pleasing to people as, like, actual
real instruments.
Recorded instruments and voices are.
Sure.
In most cases.
True.
Would you agree?
Yeah. No, I completely agree.
Though I wonder if, as time goes on and we get better and better at creating synthesized, instrument sounds that are almost indistinguishable from real recorded instrument sounds, if this will become more and more of a possibility.
Sure. This discussion always reminds me of that one episode of Next Generation where Data was playing a violin concert. And that one doctor who wasn't Crusher, who was really mean to him all the time, really got on his case about it. She was like, yeah, you were technically perfect, but there was no emotion in the music. And whether or not flaws in the playing of music are somehow critical to the human experience of that kind of sound.
No, to be fair, that woman only knew one emotion and it was irritated.
I sympathize with that point of view. While on the one hand, I'm excited about the possibility for this kind of technology, on the other hand, I think so many of my favorite songs, what's my favorite thing about them is, I don't know, something imperceptible about the sort of emotional presentation that the performer brings to the song.
Right, sure.
And not just like the sequence of notes in its relative harmonies.
Mm-hmm. Although at the same time, you could argue that if a musician is creating an algorithm that's creating a song, it's just a form of an instrument.
Could be, but then again, I think about, I'll just make it more concrete. One of my favorite musicians is Neil Young. I love Neil Young, but he's got this sloppiness about how he plays, about how he plays his guitar. There's nothing precise about it. It's very half drunk kind of sounding.
Well, I was about to say, similarly, like if you're a big Tom Waits fan, I don't think you're ever going to get a song like "The Algorithm Has Been Drinking."
I kind of hope not.
And it's hard for me to imagine that, an algorithm could reproduce that because it seems so essentially human. But then again, you know, I don't want to overestimate my powers of detection. Who knows? I mean, somebody maybe could create something that I just wouldn't be able to tell the difference.
Maybe in 20 to 40 years. And of course, depending upon your opinion of certain pop song artists, you might think that if you had a computer create, that's exactly what it would sound like.
Oh, well, yeah. In some cases, with some types of music, and not even to deride it, I'd just say nothing at all against electronic music, but let's say electronic music, I think, is much more susceptible to something like this. The kind
because
of algorithmic.
It's not being played by three-dimensional instruments to begin with, so therefore,
right.
Or it might not be,
or it might not be, right?
Or apologies. It might be. I mean, there's a lot of great electronic music that's not even performed in real time. It's just programmed music. It's programmed by a human composer.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that again, it doesn't mean that's any less valuable or quality-wise that it's any different from any other music. Obviously, if the music evokes some response from you, there's something about it that is meaningful to you.
Yeah.
So we don't mean to say that electronic is somehow
absolutely not. No,
inferior
it can be very,
to the
very
other
emotional.
Experience.
No, and in the end, I think the hardest hurdle, so we've mentioned all these things, the instruments, the hardest one is going to be vocals. Vocal music is most of the most popular music, I think, involves vocalization, human voice. I don't even know how we're going to begin to have the idea of reproducing that. So mostly what I'm thinking about with this AI composition is instrumental music.
Sure. So I could actually easily imagine in maybe a decade's worth of time that we'll have a movie score that was completely composed by computer. I can actually imagine that, particularly if you are able to feed into the computer's algorithm the timestamps of your movie, so you know that this moment I need it to have a sense of urgency, and this moment I need to build tension, this needs to be a release moment, that kind of thing. I could actually see that happening at one point.
Kind of the opposite of having a visualization of music, an auto-generated visualization.
Yeah.
Actually, one way I can really see this being a big deal is in scoring video games.
Sure.
Ooh.
In video games, you want your music to respond dynamically to what's happening in the game, but there you don't have direct control like you do when you're scoring a movie over the exact timing. So you could have this AI composition responding to the player in real time.
Yeah, that'd be great.
That'd be wonderful. So that's one of the things that can really take me out of a video game, actually, when the music is either too repetitive or lags behind following me in what I'm doing.
I can tell you that if the music didn't change when I was being chased by a ghost to the point where I'm chasing the ghost after I've eaten the power pellet, I would never play Pac-Man.
Well, you know, you're talking about the incorporation of data there into
music. Yeah, that
music.
Kind of thing. It would be data. The data about what's going on in the game would be informing the algorithm that tells what the music should sound like at any given moment.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there are all kinds of other ways you can use data to create music.
Right. The sonification or audification of data is a big topic these days in music composition. A few people who are working, more than a few people who are working in this. One of the more interesting stories, I think, is a gentleman by the name of Robert Alexander. He is currently a NASA fellow, started off as a University of Michigan student, who is working with raw satellite data from the Solar and Heliospheric Observatory, which is one of those NASA ESA satellites that has been recording data from the sun for the past, say, 13 years. Back in 2009, he created a story of a musical journey from the Earth to the Sun based on a year of data of from 2003, and did things like added drums to represent the passage of time because he was compressing all of these data points down into something like 44,100 data points per second, which happens to be about the hertz of CD quality audio sound.
Interesting.
So, which happens to equal out to every eight measures being a single solar day. And
really interesting. I also, just a trivia note, so Robert Alexander, you said, went to the University of Michigan. That's also where Sid Meier went. So
really?
Apparently the computer musician types all like to gather over at the University of Michigan.
But, you know, he started, the really interesting part about this is that he was looking at lots of data, like many different streams of data from these spectroscopes and the satellites, and One element that he started noticing a pattern from was carbon, and the people at NASA that he had been talking to about this data had never really mentioned carbon before. And through his creation of this music and through his analyzing it as a sound pattern, realized that that you could use sonified data to analyze solar, wind, and flares.
Wow.
And so knew, I mean, this changed the way that we study the sun. His music has changed that, and that's really, you know, and there's a whole bunch of people who are working in stuff like that. The astrophysicist Luciana Walkowitz has taken data from the Kepler mission, which searches for planets in other solar systems.
Yeah, the exoplanet search.
Right. And, you know, uses the light frequency of stars, which changes as stars and objects move around, mixes in things like Buddhist chants, and creates some really haunting things. The folks at the Large Hadron Collider have started up a sonification department, and so you can listen to musical compositions based on the sweep of the Atlas detector.
I heard something like this. Maybe it might not have been from that, but where did I hear it? Somebody created, essentially it was the sound of the Big Bang?
Because you can, you know.
It's weird because it starts with, our whole universe was in a hot, dense state.
Sorry.
Yeah. you know, you can track the motion of subatomic particles and turn that. I mean, basically anything in the electromagnetic spectrum, most of it's out of our audible spectrum, but you can kind of scale and transfer things down into something that you can hear. And,
right.
and all of these sounds of the universe, right down to one of my favorite examples, which is, you know, the magnetosphere around the Earth
mm-hmm.
creates non-audible sound continuously. It's kind of a very chirping sort of noise. I wouldn't necessarily call it music, but I wouldn't necessarily call Japanese noise music either. So it's really interesting to listen to.
It's kind of cool. Yeah. And, you mentioned in the script, Joe, for the video show, the guy who used points of GPS data to turn in that into music.
Yeah. That's a little closer to home, I guess, than these amazing sort of atmosphere.
Depending upon where you are when you get the GPS data.
Right. You can turn like these big worldwide kind of data points from the natural world into music, but we can also, and so that gives us a new perspective on, you know, the
what's
world.
What's out there. Yeah.
We can also get a new perspective on ourselves because, what this guy did, he was the artist Brian House.
So he made house music?
he made this really cool song. There's a great article about it. We'll link up when we put the blog post. And we'll put a link to the song up too, because you should hear it. He turned a year's worth of location tracking data on himself into music. And so it worked the way most data, or all data generated music works, is that you have a data set and each different value represents, say, a different rhythm or a different pitch.
Right.
And so the way this music worked was everywhere he went, it would track his location and that would represent a different pitch along the musical scale. And played at high speed, you can hear yourself traveling throughout the day in these very predictable patterns. But then say like when you go on vacation, there's this strange sort of like bridge that goes into a different sonic territory. And the song it creates is really hypnotic.
Interesting.
It's cool to listen to. You should check it out. And it's cool not just because of how it sounds, but because of how it gives you a new way of thinking about what you do with your life.
Mm. Sure. And, you know, all of this lets us look at things from a slightly different angle and notice patterns. I mean, the human ear and the human brain interpret music much differently than other data. And so, you know, this kind of thing has been used to study epilepsy EEGs, electroencephalograms.
Yeah.
To figure out what exactly is going on.
That's interesting.
In people's brains. And, seismographic data collected from volcanoes. It can potentially be used to help blind people see paintings or other images.
See, I could imagine even this being connected to something like an activity tracker, and then you can turn that into some sort of sound, and you can actually hear what your activity would be like during a day, and maybe it gets to a very soothing, lulling kind of tone where you realize, man, I might need to get up and move around a little more. I want to have more of a Ramones lifestyle and less of a Yanni lifestyle. No, I'm being serious, though. I mean, that can really be a way of learning more about yourself. I mean, we're talking, like, on different levels, whether it's, the activity of your brain or really just learning in a new way, like, how you are behaving throughout the day.
Yeah, totally.
Anything, you know, we've talked before about big data, and I think that really feeds into this. I mean, you know, whenever we are collecting that many points of information.
Well, let me ask you guys a question. What if we were to ask a bunch of people what were the things they liked about music, and then take all the information we had gathered.
Oh, I know where you're going with this.
Where they've told us all the things that make music great, the best of the best. This is the stuff that resonates. And then we made the best song ever written based upon that data.
Okay, so I found a couple old articles.
I actually remember when these came out, but here's the thing. I never listened to these songs.
Until
you made me, and I am so thankful you did.
There are a couple of songs that I think mitigate our enthusiasm for the for the self-tailored music. Remember we talked about
with the
AI composition, the idea that you could get a song tailored to exactly all the things you want. Turns out it might be that getting exactly the song you want is not a good idea.
Yeah, so this was something that a trio of gentlemen attempted to do. Vitaly Komar, Alex Melamed, and David Soldier. And they did a survey where they asked people about the things they liked about music, compiled all that information and then ranked it. And then through that compilation, they said, all right, these are the different elements that people really enjoy. And among those, by the way, this was a 500 person survey. So you might argue it's not very scientifically rigorous.
Oh, 500. You know, that's a lot of people.
That's right. that represents the entire width and breadth of musical
humanity.
Tastes. So
that, you're saying what they liked the most.
Yeah, these are the things in songs that they liked the most. That includes songs about love, the soprano saxophone, also the tenor saxophone, the concept of humble ambition, cheesy electronic drums.
Drum fills, right?
Drum fills. Also, working the night shift. Apparently someone was thinking of a very specific song on that one.
The world loves Bob Seger.
I guess so. String swells, also power chords. And finally, and these come from an article that or blog post from Wired, and which is a fantastic one. And the Wired posts actually contain the songs. You can actually download the MP3s if you like, and we will include a link.
Yeah, we'll link these
because
in the blog
these are
post.
Really important, guys.
But the final touch that they mention is a saccharine male and female harmonies.
Also, Paradise by the Dashboard Light.
Wait, no, this is turning into easy listening. I wouldn't call Paradise by the Dashboard Light easy listening.
Wait, does that have male and female, or was that a...
No, Paradise by the Dashboard Light has male
and
female.
Okay, I'm not thinking if I would do
Stop
anything
right
for love.
There.
Okay.
That's all I can sing, because won't let me do anymore. No, anyway, they took all these things and they wrote a song. And it's possibly one of the worst songs I've ever
really
listened
terrible.
To. It is awful. Okay, well, first of all,
I think consciously so. We're not dissing them.
No. No, I think even they were doing this totally tongue in cheek. It's an experience. You really have to go and listen to it. But when I first started listening, the first thing I thought was, I feel like I'm in the dentist's waiting room to this is the uncomfortable experience I have before I have to go and have an even more uncomfortable experience of having my teeth drilled.
So this introduces the idea that maybe we shouldn't get everything we want. Maybe it's worth trusting some experts to create music for us.
Well, before we get too far into that, let's also point out this most wanted song, which, by the way, is preceded by a voice saying, most wanted song, and then it goes into it, is about 5 minutes long. Mm-hmm. They also did one for the most unwanted song, where they tried to pull together all the elements that people said they did not like typically in music.
Like holiday music, bagpipes, a pipe organ, children's choruses,
accordion, banjo,
Walmart,
rapping, and opera.
So you cowboys.
You have an operatic singer rapping about being a cowboy, and then you have children burst in to sing about holidays and shopping.
Oh, children's choruses,
And children in general. The children's chorus jumps in randomly and starts to sing about various holidays.
We should just stop describing it and let them listen.
It's also, I have to say, I don't think I'll ever be able to hear any kind of holiday song ever again without immediately thinking of the phrase "shop at Walmart."
this had all three of us just doubled over at our desks earlier today.
And while the most wanted song is 5 minutes long, the most unwanted song is about 22 minutes long. And well worth the 22-minute time commitment it will take to listen from
it
the
is.
Beginning to end.
I found it quite enjoyable and reminded me less of the couple skate at roller skating rinks when I was like 12. So overall.
You mean reminded you of that less than the wanted
than,
song.
Than the right. wanted song.
Right.
So
I will say that the unwanted song also to me sounded like if you had mixed They Might Be Giants song Fingertips, which was a collection of little songs all smashed together. So it wasn't. There's no real theme, and there's no, like, each little vignette is very different from the one that precedes it and the one that follows it. So it was kind of like that because there were a lot of mishmashes in this 22-minute long song. It also reminded me of the musical comedy of PDQ Bach, which is Peter Schickele is behind that, and it's he has invented out of whole cloth a fictional son of Johann Sebastian Bach, who is a who wanted to be a great composer but failed in almost every respect. And if you ever listen to PDQ Bach's music and you listen to this most unwanted song, you're going to recognize some themes. And part of that is because Peter Schickele, when he makes these PDQ Bach pieces, is specifically incorporating things that are quote-unquote wrong. They are breaking the rules, not following the rules of musical composition. In that case, he's doing it for comedy. You could argue that the most unwanted song does the same, you know, does it for the same reason. I found it hilarious. And every time a new holiday came up, I was like, yay!
Yeah, as I was saying a minute ago, I think an interesting thing that the most wanted song points out is it sort of subtly underlines the idea of artistic integrity. Like, that by saying that you want all these things, it's like trying to say what you would want in a piece of music, you're ignoring the fact that a piece of music as it is now is typically created by a person.
Oh, right, and it's not like a burger. It's not like you can just go in and say, like, hey, so I want these things and none of those other things.
I mean, apparently you can do that, but it turns out the burger might be better if you just trust the chef.
Now, what's interesting is I would argue that a lot of pop music that comes out, not all of it, but a lot of it, is essentially made to a formula. So there is some very formulaic music out there that is very popular. It's just that this was taking it to a ridiculous extreme.
There is. Well, and it's also a lot of pop music is also written by very few people and farmed out to the artists.
So. Hey, let's not just say pop music. I mean,
oh, sure.
I think in some ways, pretty much all music or almost all music is formulaic.
Mm-hmm.
Even the most, you know, what we would say, quote, authentic music is formulaic in a way. I mean, there are like,
there are conventions of music.
There's 12 bar blues.
You know. Right, right, right. That is true. I'm just thinking of a much narrower set of conventions for the particular, kind of like, you know, like when you're thinking about a very specific subgenre, like bubblegum pop, it's got this very specific sound to it. And, you know, that's one of those things where I'm not saying you don't have to have talent to produce it. It's just that it's one of those things where if I listen to more than 5 or 6 songs, I can't tell where it stopped and where it began. But then I'm also old and I yell at people to get off my lawn. So.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, there's that.
I'm curious to see where musical composition goes in the future.
I am too. And also, you know, again, just to remind everybody, we are going to have blog posts up where we're going to have links to all this stuff. And you can get those MP3s of the most wanted song and most unwanted song. They are still available. So if you want to get your grubby little musical hands on those, we'll show you where to go. And I don't know why you wouldn't. These things are brilliant in their own kind of awful way. Meanwhile, if you want to join in on the conversation, what you should do is go to fwthinking.com. That's the website where we've got all the podcasts, all the blog posts, the videos. We've got articles there. You can join in on the conversation. Let us know what you think is the best song ever written or maybe the worst song ever written. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on both of those.
Or if you can imagine listening to a song created by a computer.
Yeah, let us know. I mean, maybe you already have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, get in touch with us, let us know what you think, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.